It's true, the Bible has long been wielded in the interests of our enemies. But here at Faith and Capital, we believe the scriptures can serve as a weapon for the people. Hello and welcome. You are listening to another episode of Bible in Red. My goodness. Hello and welcome everyone to our second Bible in Red episode. Now it's a series. I guess the first episode, you really can't call it a series because it was only one episode. And Chris, what was that one about?
Oh, hell if I know.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time remembering too, but hey, it's a couple episodes ago and it seems like people are really finding it interesting and enjoying it. So check that one out. But here we are. Today we're going to be discussing determination, commitment, and discipline. And now, we think that these themes, determination, commitment, and discipline, these values, have implications for our personal lives, for our communities, and definitely our organizations that we're a part of. And as we'll talk about later on, you know, I definitely think that there's spiritual and political implications. There's also like right mental and physical. So we could apply these themes in lots of areas of our lives, and we'll try and give a bunch of different examples, but we really do want people to be thinking about, well, how does this speak to my personal life, my spiritual life, my organization that I'm a part of, community, et cetera. Yeah. All right. So, Chris, what do you think? Today we are discussing Luke 5, 17 through 26. Do you want to kick us off with the reading? We'll make some observations later on. Then we'll make some reflections on the topic and wrap it up, returning to the text.
Absolutely. Let's jump in. If you would, grab the pew Bible from the pew in front of you and we'll get started.
Right in front of your sight.
Luke chapter 5, verses 17 through 26. One day, while he was teaching, Pharisees and teachers of the law were sitting nearby. They had come from every village in Galilee and Judea and from Jerusalem. And the power of the Lord was with him to heal. Just then some men came, carrying a paralyzed man on a bed. They were trying to bring him in and lay him before Jesus.
Jesus!
But finding no way to bring him in because of the crowd, they went up to the roof and let him down with his bed through the tiles in the middle of the crowd in front of Jesus.
Jesus!
When he saw their faith, he said, "Friend, your sins are forgiven you." Then the scribes and Pharisees began to question, "Who is this who is speaking blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God alone?" When Jesus perceived their questionings, he answered them, "Why do you raise such questions in your hearts? Which is easier, to say, 'Your sins are forgiven you,' or to say, 'Stand up and walk'? But so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the one who was paralyzed, "I say to you, stand up and take your bed and go home." Immediately he stood up before them, took what he had been lying on, and went to his home, glorifying God. Amazement seized all of them, and they glorified God, and wait for it, they were filled with awe, saying, "We have seen strange things today." And here ends the reading.
All right, yeah, we have seen some weird-ass things today. Excellent. Well, now we want to move into a section where we make some observations, some general observations from the text that has to do with our themes. And first of all, you know, when I first read this text, I was wanting to kind of fill in the gaps of this text because the story says there was a paralyzed man. Jesus was in this house. Some friends, I guess, apparently wanted to bring the paralyzed man and they dropped him through the roof. And of course, there's some stuff that happens later on, but I guess I was just wondering, I'm like, what were the relationships between these people and the paralyzed person, like, right? How long had they watched their friend or their loved one suffer from paralyzation? I want us to think about maybe they had worked together, or grown up running and playing together. Chris and I, maybe they grew up going to youth convention together, you know? Or walked in the city one day and the next man, this guy was paralyzed. So how many times had they been overcome throughout this relationship with great compassion and empathy for this man and openly wept? Because I don't think it's something you do randomly or without thought or without being developed. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, that's a great point, that lowering this guy through the roof was not step one.
So, oh, yes, yes.
So it begins with having compassion on their friend, a relationship where they care deeply about one another. It probably begins with trying to get this man the care he needs in other ways before you drop him through the roof in front of a rabbi healed. Like, yeah, that's great. Wondering about the relationship that already existed that would propel these guys to take the tile off the roof and drop their friend from the ceiling, which is just a ridiculous idea.
Yeah. Politely. They were like, excuse me, I'm going to chip off this roof here. Yeah, no. And
excuse
and
us.
excuse us. We tried to come through the back door, but they said, fuck off. And so we wanted to politely come through the roof. No. Obviously, this relationship like transformed these people, because you don't carry someone to however far away, right? And then you don't break into someone's house. You don't blow off their roof passively or indifferently. There was clearly this relationship had been developed, and passion and commitment and determination, I think, was developed within these people and within this community for this to happen. So some things I was wondering, and again, the text doesn't really explain, but I can't help but think about, is how far were they when they heard that Jesus was where he was at? And then how fast did they have to run to see him? And for anyone who's ever did any kind of physical strenuous activity before, you know, like, I wonder if their biceps or their back muscles were ripping or about to tear from carrying a full grown man, perhaps for miles. Another question that popped in my mind is, did their community sacrifice maybe a meal or three, just so that these men could stop laboring, right? Stop producing for the community and carry their paralyzed friend to a supposed healer?
That's a great question too. So you're asking about the community behind this immediate community that's trying to help their friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really good question.
Yeah, what sacrifice had to be made, right? Not just physically of the individuals, but also perhaps there was communal sacrifice just so these guys could get their friend to the doorstep. And as we've kind of hinted at, is it seems like you would think that there would have to be deep concern rooted in real relationship with and genuine love for this man that would lead the group of people to a very militant commitment, right? And seeing this effort to get him to Jesus through. And I do want to recognize that there is this other possibility, and I don't want to go here today, but I do want to name it, because in our recent conversation with Christina Pedersen, it was named that at least the book of Acts was written in a context of slavery, and so was Luke. I think both Luke and Acts were written by the same author. And so another part of me wondered is, what if these people weren't even friends? What if maybe one person was a friend, but the rest were slaves? And so I want to throw in this like contextual piece where actually maybe they weren't friends. Maybe they were actually enslaved people forced to do this. So that could be a whole nother direction with the interpretation. But for the purposes of this conversation, I want to stick with the assumption that these were friends who were grasped and taken and seized by this love and this concern for their paralytic friend.
Yeah, well, true. Good point. The other thing I want to point out is in verses 17 and 18, it's not just that there was a crowd of people. It's a particular kind of crowd of people. It's religious folks. It's powerful folks. And I think Luke wants us to see that. I don't think we're really going to like dwell on that today as we're talking about this text. But just something to point out, in the larger project that Luke is up to, it matters that it's Pharisees surrounding Jesus. That's a whole can of worms, right? But it's an important detail to know anyway.
Oh my God, no. That's perfectly aligned with verse 19 too, right? Because verse 19 reads, "But finding no way to bring him in because of the crowd, right? They went up to the roof and let him down with his bed through the tiles into the middle of the crowd in front of Jesus." And so I think what you're saying is very interesting. I didn't pick up on that. I didn't see that in my first reading. There were real barriers. On one hand, walls, real walls, and then a thick crowd of people, but not just any people, as you're saying. They were people of communal privilege. They were people of actual power within their community. Were they the ruling elites? Probably not. But within this context, they had more money than most, and they seriously did have social and political power within their community. Perhaps puppets of what we would call the ruling class and the ruling elite in that era.
Mm-hmm. It's also important to remember, though, that the Pharisees aren't like the social bad guy, as mm-hmm. you know, many of us who come from more conservative Christian traditions are taught to think, like the Pharisees are the real enemy. That's not the case. They were more like competitors with Jesus, doing a very similar project, all that stuff you get in seminary if there are any other nerds out there. But yeah, it's an important detail nonetheless, because Luke doesn't have to tell us who's in the crowd. He could have just said, right, the room was full of people. They couldn't get through.
Yeah, and on that point, Jesus was actually more Pharisaic than any of the other traditions. So that is actually something important for us evangelicals and Christians in general, right, to understand that Jesus was more of a Pharisee than he was anything else. But as we said, there were real barriers, and this crowd of people and the walls were those things, right? And so I also wonder, right, there was a moment where after this long travel, perhaps their biceps were ripping, their backs hurting, their legs aching. After all this effort, they came to a moment where they found no way. They had journeyed this far, gave their all. They and perhaps other community members made sacrifices, and they got to a place where they hit a literal wall and initially, for a moment, could not see how they were going to get through it. So I just want us to imagine, even though, again, the text doesn't really go into this detail, there's got to be disappointment, and then maybe some anger, and maybe the four of them had some infighting. And then I wonder even if there was a screaming match begins with a bystander at the back of the crowd, maybe even like a physical confrontation with people at the door. And one person might say, "Listen, our friend needs to see Jesus. You know, we've got to get him in there." Maybe somebody said, "Hey, get the fuck out of our way," right? Right. This is an urgent and intense moment. And I just want us to imagine that they have a paralytic friend. They made this committed journey, this struggle to get him there. And then they're not able to get to Jesus. They're feet away, yards away, and they're not able to get in. And so I just feel like this is actually a really intense moment of disappointment and anger. But finally, someone at some point says, "Fine, if they're not going to let us through the door, you know, we're going through the fucking roof." Mm. So the decision, as we've said, to hack a hole in the roof of someone else's house and drop a man into a crowd that has already made it clear it doesn't care about the paralytic man and definitely doesn't like the determination of his friends. That choice, that decision doesn't come from a place of passivity, right? This decision doesn't come from a place of indifference or, "I guess, I don't know. I guess we'll like climb up on the roof and chisel our way through the roof." The plan to blow a hole through somebody else's roof and get this guy to a known healer that could also perhaps not want anything to do with him could only come from a place of militant commitment and revolutionary determination.
Yeah, well said. It also reminds me of Miguel de la Torre's book from a few years ago called Embracing Hopelessness. He highlights this idea that, you know, when people make dangerous border crossings, it's not like a calculated decision that they think is going to work. Mm. It's likely more of a desperate act. I'm fucked either way, so I'm going to try it. And that seems kind of like to me what's happening whenever you're willing to go through the roof and drop your friend into a crowd of people. So they already hit the wall, and they realized this isn't going to work. Mm. And then suddenly, because of their determination, born out of their love, they do this batshit crazy thing to drop a guy through the roof. I don't know. That sounds like the desperation of, you know, crossing a border. Yeah, I think it's close.
Absolutely. That's a great example, right? They were driven not by this really shallow, oh, we're very hopeful about everything and everything in life, but actually there was hopelessness, there was desperation, and that really drove their determination and their commitment for their friend. Really, a great point. In verse 20, what jumped out to me there were the words, when he saw their faith. So again, for us religious people, you know, we like to emphasize our thoughts and our beliefs and other people's thoughts and beliefs, but, you know, Jesus never heard them talk about their beliefs. You know, he didn't ask them to recite the commandments or explain their thinking, right? He didn't have to. Their faith was revealed through their practice, right? Through their collective action. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, they weren't committed to their friend in theory. They didn't simply love their friend up in their heads or solely in their hearts or think it was the right thing to do. You know, their faith was practiced, it was embodied and realized, you know, and their love for their friend was manifested. And Jesus saw this. And also to your point about the desperation and hopelessness, this was all done without certainty, right? There was a risk involved. There was no guarantee that Jesus would even heal him, let alone welcome them. And so there was no certainty that the crowd wouldn't throw these men off the roof afterwards. And yet they were determined against all odds to try and get their friend healed.
Another question that comes up for me is, did these guys feel like any of them had anything to lose? And I'm kind of foreshadowing, but I think about the proletariat having nothing left to lose but their chains. I wonder if these guys could fall into that category of nothing to protect, no status, no position to protect.
Well, I think it's interesting. This act of radical love might not actually solely be placed on internal feelings, but actually perhaps it's even based on a material base, right? The material necessity of these people who have nothing to lose but their chains.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. All right, Chris. So let's go ahead and move to this general theme, this topic of determination, commitment, and discipline. And I think the purpose, you know, the goal of critically thinking about these themes, but also trying to allow these values to shape our actual ways of being in the world is to transform us, right? To transform our desires, our habits and daily routines, our real faith in the world, and our ways of being. And as we said at the beginning of the episode, I think determination, commitment, and discipline, these values can have implications for our personal lives, our faith communities, especially our organizations. They can impact our spiritual lives and also our political practice, our mental well-being, and how we relate to our bodies physically.
And talking about determination, commitment, discipline, these are not sexy ideas. You probably wouldn't have clicked on a podcast that wanted to talk about discipline.
So
these values that we're talking about today contrast with what we think are the dominant values and practices of the society in which we live, of capitalist, imperialist society. And that's the value of individual consumption, the value of self-pleasure, self-indulgence, of escapism, of self-protection, of this insistence to avoid all suffering and tension and challenge, avoiding confrontation. So these are the values that we think that are most prevalent in society. And so determination, commitment, and discipline are new for most of us to try and become people who are more determined, committed, disciplined.
Yeah, I mean, they're new for me. I have been raised to consume for my individual pleasure, especially in terms of food, which I'll say more maybe about in a few minutes here. But I remember, like, growing up, I was told to eat until I was full rather than have any kind of discipline around eating or other parts of my life as well. But yeah. Let's talk about it, you know, and in my head, I think, you know, we can break this up a little bit. Determination and commitment kind of go together, and then we'll talk about discipline. So let's first dive into revolutionary determination and militant commitment. One thing that popped in my mind when I was thinking about determination and commitment is the necessity of criticism and self-criticism. And criticism and self-criticism comes from Maoism's rupture and continuity from Marxism-Leninism, and it's Maoism's development of revolutionary science. And I think I always like to start with self-criticism. I don't know about you, Chris, but self-criticism, I think, can really help us in developing determination and commitment, right? Thinking about what concerns us daily, weekly, looking at our habits that we've formed, not over just a few weeks or a few months, but literally years, habits that we were raised in our communities and our families. And I think the goal of this self-criticism, this self-reflection and analysis is to develop new routines, new ways of spending our time. Chris, any thoughts on self-criticism in relation to determination and commitment?
I think that's all great. I would add that, you know, self-crit and criticism are not just for communists in an organization, but they're also excellent practices for regular old church folk who are trying to cultivate practices within themselves that are good for the community, good for society. And if you're like us, kind of trying to do both, to be in a communist organization and trying to be a Christian, you really don't need to draw a line here, because self-criticism is how we determine, you know, there are certain practices in my life that make it hard for me to relate well with others, to love others, even those in my church or in my cadre, what have you. The same goes for your church, your family. So self-criticism and criticism are incredibly important for, you know, every community we're involved in, if we can learn to use them well.
Yeah, that's a great point too, right? Because self-criticism isn't about self-deprecation or self-hate or self-loathing or even like performing this faux humility. But self-criticism is important because we love ourselves, because we love our community, because we want our organization and its concerns to thrive. So we self-critique out of self-love. You know, we self-critique to make our community better, and then we definitely self-critique in organizations to advance our organization's struggles and concerns.
Yeah, it cuts against liberalism. It cuts against, you know, our inability to handle conflict. But it's a leaning into the conflict out of love. That's how I like to think about self-criticism.
Yeah. Even when it hurts. Cool. Then the other half of criticism and self-criticism is, well, criticism. And the first thing that popped in my mind about this is that criticism can only be made when the people criticizing and being criticized are on an established foundation of mutual interests and concern. So if we're trying to develop determination and commitment with other people, again, whether maybe that's a friend, maybe that's a loved one, a community, or within an organization, there has to be an established like trust, an established commitment to whatever, you know, y'all are committed to. Because if there isn't that sense of trust, you could criticize someone and they just explode and blow up. There are certain people in my personal and communal life that I can critique, but then there are others that I simply can't critique, and you know, and they can't critique me because we don't have that established foundation. But within an organization, a revolutionary organization, the foundation is the class struggle. So yeah, I think that's just important to kind of get out there, because criticism isn't like blaming or trashing or publicly shaming somebody else that you're not in a mutual confidence, a mutual trust in. But criticism, like self-criticism, is about developing us personally, communally, or organizationally.
Yeah, and on one hand, I'm sure people already get this, because if you've had a partner or a person you love and you've had to say, hey, when you do this thing, I'm affected, it hurts, I don't like it, could you think about it? I think, you know, we've all done that. It's applying that principle to the organization, the community.
And because we are discussing determination commitment, which, as Chris said earlier, you know, these are not just like embedded values of our society, right? They're very counter our society. And so they're hard to develop. They take a long – they're going to take – especially for us in the United States, they're going to take a long time to develop, right? Not just – we're not talking about a week or a month or a year. We're talking about like decades of developing revolutionary determination and militant commitment. And as hard as it may be, I think there's this tendency to actually impede other people's development, especially the revolutionary movement's development, because we want to be liked or seen as a nice person, right? And so I'll speak for myself. There have been moments where I've put my personal gain or my personal appearance over the communal good because I've been afraid to critique.
Oh, absolutely. I go back and forth on this. Sometimes I think it is self-criticism that's more difficult. At least for me, you know, cracking my shell open and admitting that I fail often is difficult. But then, yeah, when you think about like when you need to tell somebody else they fucked up and the anxiety that can cause, I didn't feel that way until I had to do it. And I'm like, oh, shit. It's all difficult.
Yeah, it really is.
So I don't know that I could pick one.
That's so true. Yeah. And another point I wanted to bring up was commitment has to be based on deep critical reflection and personal engagement, as opposed to like a passive obedience or an indifferent submission, right? When we're talking about commitment and or even we might say faithfulness, that's not blind or thoughtless, but it actually should come from a place of deep critical thought and critique and engagement, right? When a loved one or a community member or a member in an organization brings something to the table, you should deeply wrestle with it rather than just passively accept things, I think. And I think that actually is a different kind of commitment than the commitment that says, no, you're not supposed to think, you're not supposed to engage it, you're not supposed to ask questions. But this kind of commitment, this revolutionary commitment, expects you or presumes that you're going to ruthlessly critique it.
And I think that goes into the next point pretty well, that we are bound to failure. Because let's get theological for a second. We are not God. We are imperfect. We are unfinished. We are finite. So we should understand this, that we are going to fail one another. We're going to fail ourselves. We're going to fail the movements we're a part of at times. Yeah. So the criticism and self-criticism idea is critical because we already know that we are unfinished and we're going to fail. Or we should.
That's a great point, right? There's this kind of spiritual lens where we talk about, you know, we are endlessly unfinished and we're finite. Right? Embracing our finitude is hard, but we will fail. And then on the other hand, organizationally, we're definitely going to fail. Anyone in an organization knows that. And so I think that's really beautiful. Or even one last thing that pops in my mind is just our communities. Think about how the faith communities that we're all a part of. Think about the great failures of our faith communities, our collective failure. And perhaps that's even harder to approach as faith communities because our faith communities do not often discuss, let alone value our failures and our criticism within our spaces. So yeah, that's a great point.
Mm-hmm. That's why I love the practice of communal confession in churches. And that's all I'll say about that. But if your church doesn't do that and you'd like to suggest something, I think that's a great idea.
That actually really spoke to me when I was in college after I had transitioned out of my evangelical fundamentalism. I didn't grow up with communal confession. And then when I went into a church where we had that, I thought it was just absolutely just transformative. So great point. The two, in terms of organizations and transforming the world, the two main issues where determination and commitment really need developed for me myself, and then also I think for us really committed to liberation is in our study and in our mass work. Yeah, I just wanted to throw those out there because I think that's where a lot of us really struggle. First, to actually be studying our histories and revolutionary theory, but then also to actually get our asses off the couch and do some real mass work. All right, so we have revolutionary determination, we have militant commitment, and now let's talk about a kind of particular discipline. So let's pit bourgeois discipline, which I think we're all more familiar with here in the U.S. and across the world. And then there's a proletarian discipline.
Yeah, so you probably, if you're listening to this, you might not think of yourself as a super disciplined person. Mm-hmm. But I assure you that you are disciplined in the bourgeois sense. So you clock in, you show up to work every day, and you stay for a certain amount of hours, more hours than you'd like to be there. You do work that you don't want to do often. You already are disciplined in the capitalist sense towards the end of the capitalist profit motive, right? So discipline itself is not a good or bad thing. Mm. It is a thing that can serve the bourgeois or the proletariat.
Yeah, I really like that. You're emphasizing that discipline is neither necessarily good nor bad, but it's in whose class interest. It's who does it materially impact. And while on one hand, I want to just reject all discipline. It's like discipline, ooh, no, don't suppress me. Don't expect anything of me. All discipline is about subordinating me. But actually, I think this is what we're talking about when we talk about bourgeois discipline. It's this discipline that's really fueled by fear. Because I'll tell you what, when I get up at 3 a.m. every morning for work, that takes discipline to wake my body up at 3 a.m. for work. But it's a discipline out of fear, out of material coercion, because I am not in the class of power. I'm in the working class here in the U.S. And our bourgeoisie has made it materially necessary, where I get to work and I work a 12, 13 hour shift and I get home and my body hurts. So yeah, I think there's a discipline that's more common in our society that's about subordination, about passivity, about just kind of like blind acceptance and falling in line. But in this bourgeois discipline that is predominant amongst the masses of working and colonized people here and across the world, serves the interests of bourgeoisies, colonizers, imperialists, oppressors in general. And so, yeah, then there's a proletarian discipline, which I think is fundamentally different in, as you're saying, character. I like that. There's a different kind of discipline here. And it's different because it serves different interests. It serves different class interests. It serves different interests of the people rather than exploiters and oppressors.
Yeah, you've already named how, as we're already disciplined by the capitalist class, whenever we get home, our bodies are tired. Mm. We are exhausted emotionally, spiritually, socially. And yet, we still have these meetings if we're communists, if we're Christians. We still have things in the world we're up to. So we're talking about the kind of discipline that makes you show up for the meeting on time, the kind of discipline that leads you to actually do the reading before the study group, and the kind of discipline that makes you knock on the door and talk to your neighbors even when you really don't want to, when you'd rather flip on Netflix and have a bag of chips. We've all been there, and we need to cultivate this proletarian discipline so that we can get anything done in the world. What do you think, Chase?
Yeah, that's a great point. There are both seasons and even moments, you know, throughout my week where I don't want to go do this action. I don't want to show up for this meeting. I don't want to drive to the other side of the city and spend either 30 minutes or, you know, 3 hours. There are moments where discipline kicks in because I'm committed to something. I'm determined to be committed to something rather than putting my own self-indulgence and my own self-interests in front of the movements or the people's well-being. So yeah, we could talk about organizational discipline, but also, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I have really struggled with discipline around food and drink, like consuming this food and drink in general. And it's because I was raised. I'm 29 years old. For the first like 20 plus years of my life, I was socialized in a culture and also in a family where we were told to just eat and drink until we were full. And I don't know, maybe some other people can resonate with that, but that was a habit that I've really had to develop some serious discipline on, and I continue to struggle with it, but I will say I've consciously been able to develop some new habits where right now, you know, for the next 20 days, I'm going to go 20 days without drinking, and, you know, I got some accountability, but it's a challenge for me to say no to my food and my drinking habits, to not just eat the entire pizza in front of me, or to not get a second of servings, but to really develop some discipline in my consumption.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right there with you. I would say that also in the church, there are practices that we have that can help us think about our habits that become uncritical. Like during Lent, for example, some people will give up something. And often these maybe aren't the most spiritually gratifying things. You know, I want to lose 10 pounds during Lent or something. Yeah. I think in addition to the modes of consumption that, you know, become part of us through our upbringing and whatnot, I think for me, it's just like not being critical of the basic things I do, of, you know, spending most of my day just coasting. And there are a couple things that actually have my attention, but what I eat, what I drink, what I do with my body, those are things that I kind of just leave to wherever the wind takes me, you know? So discipline is then about like taking control back of myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Developing consciousness and becoming more present.
Mm.
Yeah, I really like that. So spiritual disciplines, spiritual practices, whether they're personally done or communally done, they can develop greater degrees of consciousness and awareness, and also help us be more present with our bodies, with the people around us, with the material world. And before we move on, one warning I think we should all be holding within our heads as we prioritize revolutionary determination and becoming more militantly committed and pursuing a proletarian discipline as opposed to a bourgeois discipline is zealotry, or maybe in other circles we might call it dogmatic thinking and practice. But especially, for anyone listening, people committed to revolutionary communism, our revolutionary commitment and determination shouldn't be guided merely by hatred, but by an undying commitment to seeing goodness and freedom and love and well-being and right relationship expressed in more fuller ways that are simply materially impossible, right? While capitalism and its relations and its ideology persist. So I do think there's this challenge that we do need greater degrees of determination, commitment, and discipline. And yet zealotry and dogmatism are just so easily infiltrated in our communities, and especially any kind of organization committed to revolutionary transformation. It's hard, right? The conditions impose it upon us to become this committed and this disciplined. But on the other hand, we'll always have this challenge of being dogmatic or basically becoming zealots. What do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, that more adventuristic errors, if we're talking like from a Maoist or revolutionary communist point of view, are always present. And the more we get in touch with the things that must be done, the more we can be tempted to go down those routes. But on the other hand, it's the relationship with the masses that tempers that and calls us to take a breath, to remain committed to what's good for the masses, to hear from the masses and not just go off our own revolutionary ideas.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I'm also thinking like aesthetically, right? Where religious people and spiritual people have dogmatically made their theologies or their spiritual practices pretty gruesomely intense. And that's often because we've become disconnected from the people, disconnected from one another, even. Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Let's wrap this up. Let's go ahead and turn to the scripture one last time. We've read this story about some friends who were deeply determined and committed to their friend's well-being, and they carried his paralyzed body to a supposed healer, and they ended up having to blow a hole through somebody else's roof. Deep determination, commitment, and discipline was necessary here. And so I think there are some things from this theme of this that we've generated from our reading of the text that we can walk away with. And the first thing I just want to say is that the struggle, whether we're talking about our relationships, the development of our communities, or people actually committed to trying to transform this world in our nations and our communities, it's not easy. We really need to develop deep senses of commitment and determination so that we can struggle with our people and start to fucking fight for our neighbors. And this requires us to push ourselves and push one another. And so I think the first thing is that we need to acknowledge the necessity of developing determination and commitment and discipline. Again, personally, communally, spiritually, but perhaps most importantly, as people committed to the revolutionary transformation of this world.
Absolutely. And we've got to remember that whether we're talking the Christian journey, the faith journey, or we're talking about revolutionary organizing, there will be tons of failure. Mm. There's going to be slow progress creeping along, and we're going to face defeats. So this determination, commitment, and discipline can cause us to keep showing up, to keep fighting, even though it doesn't look good, and sometimes it doesn't look good. If we're not determined and committed to the struggle, then we won't see any of the transformation that we hope for, dream of, work for.
Yeah, as you said early on in the episode, Chris, you know, you had mentioned when we were talking about the text that maybe this wasn't the first time they had tried to get their friend healed, right? How many failures did they have to go through? How many risks? How much sacrifice did they and the community have to make to finally get this final win for the paralyzed man?
Mm. And a good time to remember all those who came before us, who were revolutionaries, who failed, and all those who were, you know, radical Christians who also failed.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking recently about how generally there's this nihilism. It's like, oh man, the 20th century, we tried socialism, you know, and we lost. It was defeated. And it's like, well, no duh, it was defeated. I mean, it wasn't just defeated twice with Russia and China. There were lots of defeats, but there were also incredible victories in such a short period of time. Like when you start to think about, Marx was beginning to write in the 50s, 1850s. And in such a short period of time, people started to study and equip themselves, their organizations, their communities with revolutionary Marxism. And they won. Like peasants and workers and soldiers came together and communities were out on the street. I mean, I think the 20th century, even though there was great defeat, there was just incredible victory in such a short period of time. And so I don't walk away from the last 150 years feeling nihilistic. I mean, could you imagine what is possible in the next 50 years, the next 100 years in terms of communist struggle? I don't know. I think for some reason people tend, after the defeat of socialism thus far, people oddly tend towards nihilism, but I think there's room for revolutionary optimism.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm sure the nihilism's not new as well. Like, I'm sure Russian peasants felt similarly. That what the hell are we gonna do against the Tsar?
That's true. Yeah. And so this struggle, right? It takes time. And what popped in my head when I was thinking about developing determination, commitment, and discipline over time was, I oddly was obsessed with working out back in the day. And I walked away from it, but now I'm back to trying to create healthy physical discipline. And, you know, in my workouts that I do, like I'll do one for a couple, for like a month or a month or two. And it's like at one stage, and then I'll change everything up and do it for another couple of months. And then I'll change everything up and do it at another couple of months. And it's all about that slow progress of development, of developing my discipline, developing the physical strength. And so, you know, whether we're talking about exercising or the development of our communities, because we all know how our faith communities have journeyed and have struggled through real contradictions and tension, or we're talking about the organizations and the community or the justice work that we're a part of. These things take time, but if we're not determined, if we're not committed, and if we don't develop that discipline, then we really won't have much movement over the years, I think. And the last point that came to my mind, Chris, I want to hear your thoughts on it, is that our salvation, the material liberation, the ending of the fucking brutal suffering from the state, from our bosses, from imperialists and colonizers, right? Salvation belongs to those willing to fight for it. And if we're not willing to fight for it, if we don't develop revolutionary determination, if we don't develop militant commitment, if we don't practice and critique and self-critique our way to greater levels of proletarian discipline, then salvation will never be ours, right? The working classes of the world will never seize power, and we will forever be under the rule of exploiters and oppressors until our earth is destroyed. So I think that, you know, these values of determination, commitment, and discipline are just so fucking important for our spiritual and our material salvation.
Yeah, and as we've already named in this episode, there are some of us who work 12-hour shifts, who come home, and we're tired. And on one hand, it's totally understandable to be exhausted at the end of the day, at the end of your work week. And at the same time, if we cannot cultivate discipline within ourselves, in our organizations, in our churches, we lose.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
And what is, you know, what is losing, right? Losing is, you know, my grandma spending years of her life warming her house with an oven. You know, losing is when I was walking the streets of California and seeing alive human bodies just littered all over the sidewalks because our society can't house everyone, right? Losing is when my coworker has to get up the next morning and comes and tells all of us that, well, her son is being disciplined in their school for fighting back against a white kid calling him the N-word. Losing is another community, another family, another people being bombed in another nation. And so losing is real, and we have to be fucking tired of losing, I guess.
Losing is when there's a global pandemic and you think your state is going to do something about it and a million people in your country die. We're fucking losing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that the acknowledgement that we are losing, as you're saying, Chris, should ignite a fire within us and really push us to develop this personally, communally, and within our organizations. Yeah. If we want ourselves, our communities, our friends, our loved ones to be healed, if we want the earth to be healed, we have to develop the determination, the commitment, and the discipline of friends in our story.